The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show. Kind of a special event today. Every day that we have Peter Scott on is a special event. Sorry, Bob. It's kind of special with you, too. But on today's show, we've got Jim and Bob and Peter and Chris, myself, all connected through our, if you notice an audio difference, we've got all new equipment here in the recording studio we're testing out. So hopefully it's an improvement. I'm sure someone will let me know if it's not. We have that type of listenership. So let me know if there's any problems with it, but I think it's a net improvement.
But Pete and Bob are on phones, so they're going to sound different.
They definitely will sound different, but overall we should have a little bit improvement, and especially in these shows where we've got multiple people connected multiple ways. So on today's show, since we've got Peter here, it's definitely going to be estate planning or tax manipulation. Well, that's a bad word. Tax optimization focused. So
and Bob being on the show.
Yep. And welcome Pete and Bob.
Thank you.
Hi, Chris and Jim and Pete.
Okay, so everybody's going to sound a little different, folks. We apologize for that. But I wanted to bring out the hired guns today, because on this EDU show, we're going to get deep in the weeds of a very advanced topic. The topic may not apply to a lot of our listeners, but I think our listeners will find it interesting. And if it doesn't apply to them, they may know someone who it would apply to. But we're just trying to give you guys a little idea of how to think of certain strategies for the reduction of taxes, whether it's reduction of taxes in retirement or pre-retirement, but utilizing a trust mechanism that we have talked about many times on this show, a charitable trust. There are two types, charitable remainder trusts and charitable lead trusts. We've always talked about CRTs, charitable remainder trusts, but I know Pete will most likely talk about charitable lead trusts today as well. But both of these trusts are ways of putting highly appreciated assets into them and spreading out the taxation of the income that you will be receiving from them over a number of years, rather than being hit with the taxation all at once. We've talked about them many times as a way for everyone who has large IRAs. And Chris, you know, I didn't mess up. Don't look at me that way.
I was just waiting for you to get
Before we started recording, folks, Bob laid it out that he doesn't think I'll make it through this show without screwing up someone's name. So I told him that I'm going to ace it. Did I not, Bob? You still going to carry that bet?
I'm going to carry that bet. I think it's just too. I think there's just too many people in names right now for you, Jim.
Well, we shall see. I got Chris right. What was I asking you now, Chris?
Oh, so you're so concentrated on the names, you're going to give up the content?
I forgot what I was saying, but it was brilliant.
CRTs, big IRAs.
Oh, using, as you know, Chris, a lot of our listeners have rather large IRA 401k style accounts. We're talking seven figures, $2-4 million sometimes in these accounts, if not initially at the start of retirement. Later on, as they grow through retirement, they're going to be quite large. So we've talked about CRTs before. We've had Pete on the show before about a way of stretching out the massive payments that will have to happen now under the Secure Act, where these accounts have to be closed within 10 years and taxed at the beneficiary's tax rate, which would probably be your children, who will also be hopefully as successful, if not more successful, as you were. So they'll be in a very high tax bracket, and a lot of your inherited IRA is going to be lost to taxes. So we've talked about CRTs in that strategy. But there is another way, folks, of using CRTs. When you are selling perhaps a business. And what got me thinking of bringing Bob and Bob and Pete on, that I didn't mess up. It was not a mess up. I just wasn't sure. Bob, I didn't think you heard me, so I said your name twice. Did you hear me?
Yeah, no, I thought maybe there was another Bob on the phone, but we're good.
Nope, we're good. You guys don't think I'll make it through this show. I'm going to prove to you.
Well, we're 5 minutes into an hour-long show, so we'll see.
Well, so far I haven't messed up. Mm-hmm. Okay, so one of the reasons I wanted Bob on the show...
and some
where
other
was
guy.
I going with this now? See, you keep interrupting me with the name. I don't know what the heck I'm talking about anymore. Why don't I just get to the email?
Perfect.
So what I want to do, folks, is we got this email of someone who's selling, kind of selling a business, almost a business. And we're going to play around with this story and show you, or at least try talking to you, about some strategies. You're still going to have to pay taxes. But what if you didn't have to pay taxes all in the year you sold it? Now, you can do things like an installment sale and things like that. But there's also ways to spread it out using charitable remainder and charitable lead trusts. And let's get to the email first, and then I'll let Bob and Pete take over and start educating us on how some of these things will work. So I received this email, or we received this email. The email came in, I don't know, a couple weeks ago from someone in Minnesota. So a Minnesotian, I think that's how we would reference them. And they write, "We are getting ready to get out of farming in the next few years with the sale of our crops and equipment in 1 year. This will put us in a very sizable tax problem. What are your thoughts regarding charitable remainder trusts? Do you think they are too much trouble to put together to avoid paying a big tax bite? Thank you." And then they put their real name. And we, of course, will always call them George in an effort to protect their anonymity. So, Bob, let's begin with you, and why don't you educate our listeners a little bit about what this person is talking about doing. Let's not get into any of the strategies yet, Bob, just on face value. They're going to be selling crops, and they're going to be selling equipment. It's going to cause a big tax hit to them in 1 year when they sell it. And they're wondering, should they then take some of that cash after they get it all and put it in a charitable remainder trust? Will it help them? Without getting too deep in the weeds, let's look at that simple question first, Bob. And what do you think?
Well, I think that there's certainly an opportunity for them to defer some taxes and obtain a partial tax deduction. And so essentially, big picture, like what you're talking about, Jim, is rather than recognizing a bunch of income in year one, whether you're selling any kind of appreciated asset or any asset really, but appreciated assets make a bigger difference, you're going to avoid all the income taxes being recognized in year one and spread those over a period of time, and they're going to get taxed to either you or whoever is receiving the income stream from the trust, and hopefully over lower brackets over a longer period of time, and then obtaining year one deduction, charitable deduction, for the value that the charity receives when the second or first person, depending on how it's set up, passes away.
So before we get into that, because I think, and I might be wrong here, but I think you were referencing a little bit of if they were to put some of the crops or equipment into the trust and then sell it. What if they did it the way they were thinking, though? They sold everything first. It's already sold. And now they've got all the cash. So Pete and Bob, let's just pretend they put $200,000 into the farm or the equipment and the crops years ago, and they're going to sell it for $1 million. We have no idea what dollar amounts they're talking. So they're going to have an $800,000 taxable gain, Bob. So if they did it the way they're indicating in the email, and they now have $800,000 of gain, and they come to see you and they say, hey, we're thinking of putting $400,000 of this into a CRT. We heard it's going to help us lower our tax burden because we have $800,000 of gain. And as you know, Bob, and pointed out to us, the gain is pretty much going to be all income to them because it's going to be the recapture of depreciation and some other things. You can explain that in a second. So they've got $800,000 of mostly income, most probably, being taxed to them. If they put half of that into a CRT, what type of benefit are they really going to get?
Well, they're going to, one of the things about doing it that way is you have to pay the tax up front on the sale of all the crops, which is inventory and equipment, and you're going to pay for that all in year one. So while you have money left over to contribute to a CRT, from what's left over, you're going to have to pay all these taxes, this enormous tax bill that's going to hit you. And so after you've contributed to the CRT and you've paid the taxes, it really diminishes the amount of proceeds that you have left over.
And then the hope is if they put $400,000 into the CRT, they're still going to have to pay taxes on the $800,000. If my math is correct, they're still going to have to declare that $800,000. They're going to put $400,000 in, but they're not going to quite get a $400,000 deduction, are they, Bob or Pete?
No, they're not. And so they're going to ultimately the charitable deduction is going to be the estimated value of what's going to get turned over to the charity. And that's going to be based on how you structure the income stream coming back to you or your beneficiary. So the more that trust is set up with the terms that's going to have a higher payback over a longer period of time or however it's set up, the more that's going to come back, that's not charity. That's going to come back to you with an income tax component. And then the piece that's left over, the charitable intent gets smaller and smaller. There is a minimum, but that piece that's left over is the amount of the deduction.
Now, the one thing I want to try to get a little bit of clarity on, and for my sake, because you guys are the experts on this, and Pete, feel free to chime in. If $400,000 goes in, and in a standard CRT, if we did this under a charitable remainder trust where folks, the charity gets a remainder amount at the end of the term of the trust, and Pete will explain a little bit about what that means, but the standard amount or the minimum amount the charity is supposed to get is 10%. The other 90% hopefully gets paid out to the recipient of the proceeds, the beneficiary of the trust, which could very well be the person who put the money in, they are going to receive the income. So would the deduction amount on the $400,000 going in be just $40,000, Pete or Bob, or do they get a deduction on the full $400,000?
Well, I just ran some numbers. If the couple's age is 65 and 64 and it runs for both lives, they're going to get a $440,000 charitable deduction.
That's it.
For the $400,000 contribution.
And that's because under IRS rules, the minimum that can go to the charity is 10%, correct?
Well, yeah, that's probably what kicks in, but I don't think that's controlling because the interest rate that's used to calculate this is 0.8%. We're in such a low interest rate environment. If that interest rate were higher, substantially higher, then we may end up with a greater deduction for the charity. Maybe not, but with this 0.8% calculation for the present interest value, it's pretty low to charitable deduction.
Okay, so what you have here, listeners and folks who wrote this email, if you, and again, our numbers are probably wrong because you didn't give us dollar amounts you're talking, but if you had $800,000 of gain, you said it was a substantial gain you're going to have. If you had $800,000 of substantial gain after selling the crops and the equipment, and you thought, gee, I'm going to put $400,000 into a charitable remainder trust and get this big charitable deduction so I don't have to pay taxes on the full $800,000, and then I'll begin withdrawing some of that money slowly over the course of my life, Pete did some calculations on his software, and you have to understand you got to follow certain rules. He's saying the only amount that you would legitimately be able to deduct is just $40,000. So you're not going to get a big savings from a charitable remainder trust the way you've described it to us in your email, that you have crops.
Let me jump in for a minute. The $40,000 was calculated on the basis of around a 10% income rate. So they would be getting $40,000 a year for their life expectancies, their joint life expectancies. I just ran it again at only a 5%, which is the minimum amount that they would have to take out. And that will increase their charitable deduction to about a little over $131,000.
Okay, so if they take less income, like Bob was saying, they will get a slightly higher income tax deduction.
Mm-hmm. Almost like three times as big a deduction. But still, they're giving up, they're putting the $40,000 in. They're getting, then this year, $131,000 income tax deduction. But they still owe tax on the $800,000, as you pointed out.
So they're not protecting a whole lot there.
Right.
No.
So their question, is it worth it? Right now, they're not winning me over with a CRT, but there are other ways of doing this. And that's part of what I want you, and Bob, feel free to chime in anytime you'd like. That's part of what I would like you to do, Pete, is talk about, and I reached out to you when I got this email because I know during your working years, you actively did a lot of work with farmers on the eastern plains of Colorado and ranchers utilizing this strategy. And there are ways to actually get business assets and perhaps this farm or crops or equipment or any semblance of some of that into a charitable trust, whether it's a remainder or a lead trust, before you sell it and have to declare $800,000 of income, so then the trust can sell it and diversify it tax-free and begin passing out the income to you. There's ways of doing that, correct, Pete?
There is. You can put a bigger dent in that tax bill. You use a little different technique.
So you're not going to be hit with the $800,000 all at once. Before we get into charitable lead trusts, Pete, let's look at, or can you explain to our listeners in simple terms, how can you, because I know there's certain rules that need to be followed. You just can't say, oh, I'm getting ready to sell my farm, or I'm getting ready to sell this highly appreciated business that I started. I'm going to throw it into a CRT, have the CRT sell it, and start drawing out money over the rest of my life and not have to pay taxes, huge taxes in year one. It doesn't quite work that way. There are certain rules that need to be followed, right, Pete?
There are, and the IRS does look at those. And so the concern that I guess maybe the IRS's concern is that you go ahead and negotiate this transaction, sign the contract so you know it's a firm deal, then you put it into the trust. The IRS is going to say, wait a minute, we're going to treat that as though you sold the property, so now you owe the tax on the $800,000. And then you put it into the charitable remainder trust where you got a $40,000 deduction. So you're not going to get you're going to have to pay the tax on that $800,000. The idea behind putting the property in, and let's say they put half of it in at the appropriate time, and then the property sold, then they're only going to have gain on $400,000, half of, or I guess $500,000, depending on, well, gain was $800,000, that's right. So they would only have to pay tax on $400,000. The other $400,000 would be reported by the charity, and since charities don't pay any tax, there would be no tax on that portion of it in the year of sale. So that's the advantage, or I should say the disadvantage of doing it wrong, is you get hit with a tax bill on the full $800,000, but you only kept $400,000 out, so that's all you have to pay the tax on it, which means you're not going to be left with very much.
So timing is everything here. And what the IRS doesn't want you to do is negotiate the sale of your business or your farm and then say, okay, I've got this in the bag. I've got buyers. Now I'm going to start putting this farm and business into the CRT and protecting myself from a tax standpoint. You need to put the money in, excuse me, not the money. You need to put the asset, whether it's the business or the farm, or a portion of it. Doesn't have to be all of it. 10% of it, 50% of it, 100% of it, into the CRT before you negotiate the sale, correct?
Correct. And so there has to, basically the rule is that up until the time that you can no longer walk away from the transaction without penalty. So if you sign the contract, it's too late. I tend to be a little more cautious. I even suggest that they not have signed a letter of intent, even though that's more likely not binding. I think it's a little too close for my comfort level. So ideally, you may have had conversations with a potential purchaser, but nothing has been put in writing, and there's been no firm agreement on the transaction. And even then, it's a little shaky. You want to do it before there's been any serious discussions with a serious buyer, I guess would be another way to put it. So you got to be really careful you don't get too close to that contract date.
And then once the money is in the, well, actually I keep saying money, once the shares or the units or whatever you're putting in is in the CRT, and it doesn't have to be all of the ownership, correct, Pete? You can still own some, and the CRT owns some. Then you do the negotiations and complete the sale. Now, let's just say the same fact series. So follow us along, Bob, and fill in if I'm making a mistake somewhere. The people put $200,000 in years ago. The farm, crops, and equipment are now worth $1 million. So there's $800,000 of gain and $1 million total in value. I'm just making these numbers up. Somehow that has to get into some sort of ownership units. We don't have to get too deep into how that is done, but they have it set and they put half the ownership into a CRT, half the ownership they maintain. My first question is, does the basis get broken up proratedly, or can they keep the $200,000 of basis and put all gain into the CRT? Or if they're going to do 50-50, Pete or Bob, does it have to be prorated? Some of the basis is in the CRT, some of the basis is outside of the CRT.
Well, it's pretty clear you've got it's pro rata, so whatever value is, that's what goes in, and that carries with it the proportionate share of the basis.
Okay, so they decide, let's do this 50-50. We're going to put $500,000 of the crops and farm equipment inside the CRT, and we'll keep $500,000 outside. The $500,000 outside has $100,000 a basis, and the CRT has $100,000 a basis with $400,000 a gain. Then the property gets sold. Now, Bob, how much gain are they declaring on their taxes?
Well, then they would see half of the $800,000, so they'd have $400,000 dollars of gain personally, and then the rest of the gain would be recognized inside of the CRT.
And the CRT, folks, is technically a charity. Even though the donor is going to be the income recipient, it is still a charity. And that $400,000 of business can be sold tax, I don't want to say free, it's tax deferred. It's only tax free if the person died and didn't ever touch any of it. They hope to get some of that money out and they'll have to pay taxes on it, but they're not going to have to pay taxes all in year one, all in the year of the sale on that $400,000. They will have to pay taxes on the $400,000 that they kept out because they didn't put it all in the CRT. They wanted some money, say, as a lump sum, because once it's in the CRT, if I remember correctly, P, it is irrevocable, correct? And they're not going to be able to get that lump sum out anymore.
That's right.
So it's irrevocable, folks, but now you only are declaring $400,000, not $800,000. So what happens to that money inside the CRT? Pete just did a quick calculation. Why don't you tell us, Pete, what it is that happens now inside the CRT? Using the same assumptions you made that the people were in their early 60s, I forget what ages you used, and they wanted to receive income for the rest of their lives, and at the death of the second spouse, the remaining money inside the CRT, if any, will go to a charity. And I'll talk in a minute what that charity can be. But what magic do you now work, Pete, as an attorney who pulled this all together? How do you actually figure out what they're going to receive? What's going on the inside now?
Well, the terms of the charitable remainder trust will set the amount, which is if you use a unit trust or annuity, either one really, it'll set the percentage of the value that will be paid out each year. So let's say we used, in those calculations, I used a 10%, and that was to maximize the amount that would be going to the donors. And then I used a 5%, which would be the minimum amount they could take out. And the discrepancy in the two was threefold in terms of the amount of the charitable deduction. But regardless of what the percentage of payout is, the assets come into the charitable remainder trust. And then those assets are sold along with the interest of the donor. So they sell it for $1 million. There's now $500,000 in the charitable remainder trust. That amount is then invested, and the investment then will pay interest, dividends, whatever form it may take. And then out of that interest income or dividend income, that will go out on up to the maximum percentage, either the 5% or the 10% that I used earlier in the calculation. So 5% of the value of the assets in the trust will be paid out each year to the donors. If the payout rate is 10%, then it would be 10% of that value. And so if it's an annuity trust, that amount is going to be fixed for the term of the trust. If it's what's called a unit trust, that 10% is recalculated, or that 5% is recalculated each year based on the current value of the trust. So if the income is insufficient, the income earned on the $500,000 is insufficient to cover that amount that is required to be paid out, then they're going to have to invade principal. That means maybe selling some of their investments. I say they, the trustee would have to sell some of the investments in order to generate the liquid funds necessary to write a check out to the donors each year. And then that will continue for the joint lives as the way we had set it up for the couple starting out at age 64 and 65. So that would run, and just in terms of given those ages, the mortality tables suggest that it would be for a period of 23 years before both of them would die. They don't have to die at the end of 23 years, certainly not a requirement, and if they live longer, then they may end up getting more out of the trust than they put into it. But if they die sometime before that, then they're going to leave a little bit more on the table for the charity to receive after both of them have passed away.
Let me clarify one thing for our listeners before Jim goes off onto something else. Just as a reminder, when they sold this whole thing that they've got and then tried to put it in the CRT after the sale, they were only able to reduce their tax burden by the deductions of the $40,000 or the $131,000. By doing it the way Pete has just described here in the last few minutes, $400,000 of gain or income, right, that was recognized depending on the nature of those assets and the nature of the sale, all that $400,000 was avoided in the year of sale for tax purposes for the individual because all of that income got recognized inside the structure of the trust. That's the difference. So in my estimation, $400,000 is a lot better than either $40,000 or $131,000. I think we would all agree.
Absolutely, and that's the whole point of the strategy, right. And that's what...
I just want to make sure everybody's on board before we rode farther down the stream here.
And I hope everyone got that, because that's exactly when we got this email and I showed it to Bob. This is exactly what he and I started talking about and what they should be considering, and that's why I wanted to bring Pete on. So in your scenario, Pete, let's get a little bit of information here, or a little bit deeper here, because you still always mention this charity. You do have to remember, yep, folks, that at the end of the day, a charity is going to be the ultimate beneficiary of whatever is left in that trust. This is a great way to spread out income so you don't get it all hit at once. You can get it inside a trust. It can be protected inside the trust from bankruptcy and creditors. It can be held in there. I'll let Pete get into using a NIMCRUT or a NIMCRAT as a way of holding some of the distributions for protection. But once it's in there, it's never going to be yours again. You're going to get income. It's kind of like an annuity. If you were to go out and put $500,000 in an income annuity, you don't have $500,000 anymore. You have just income. So in a CRT, you're in the same scenario. You're going to defer and take income, and the theory is you can spread it out over a longer period, taking smaller amounts. And remember, in our opinion, in Chris and I's opinion, retirement should be simple but not simplistic. And the older you may really appreciate just a steady stream of income coming out of this trust every year that you, for the most part, don't have to worry about. It's not an annuity in its truest sense, but a steady stream of income coming out of this trust that some of it will be taxable to you because it's going to be a return of the income that was deferred, but some of it is going to be capital gain, some of it's going to be interest, some of it's going to be dividends. As it gets distributed out to you, it's going to retain the character of that taxation. If there was no trust involved, what would you have paid in taxes on it? So if it's a capital gain, you're going to pay cap gain taxes on some. So it does get a little bit complicated, but the trustee tracks a lot of that for you and keeps you on the up and up of what you're going to be paying as taxes and what is the return of the $100,000 of basis. And this is how the CRT will work. But at the end, when one spouse dies and then Pete, the second spouse, dies, all the money remaining, if any, and that's what we have to keep stressing, you have to set this up to be actuarially sound on day one, but 15, 20, 25 years into it, maybe the trust ran out of money and the beneficiary, the charity, may get nothing. Is that correct, Pete?
That is correct, although in this low interest environment, that's
would be hard to do.
Probably it would be hard to do. In the 80s, when interest rates were substantially higher, they didn't have the 10% minimum actuarial value for the charity in the law, and so a lot of these the donors were getting their tax deduction and getting all their money back plus its growth. And so now, at least actuarially, on day one, the trust or the charity has to have at least a 10% calculated remainder interest. Now, if interest rates go up, it may not work that way. But right now, with the low interest rates, it'd be very difficult to do.
So keep this in mind, folks. Ultimately, that money will go to charity and not to your human beneficiaries. Now, some ways around this, and Pete, you can come up with other ways, but some ways that I've heard is then people sometimes take a portion of the income they're receiving every year, buy a life insurance policy, a second to die GUL if it's going to be on two beneficiaries, and leave the life insurance policy. In other words, use some of the payments from the CRT to fund the life insurance policy that provides the lump sum inheritance that some of the future beneficiaries, children or whatever, aren't going to get. That's one way of dealing with it. But another thing to think of is the charity folks that ultimately gets it could be your own donor-advised fund that you set up. And what is a donor-advised fund? A donor-advised fund is exactly the way it sounds. It's a shared pool, if you will. It is created by someone. It can be funded later. And your proceeds from your own CRT can go into your own family donor advised fund. Doesn't help you because you've passed away. The money is still locked into the donor advised fund. The beneficiaries, your kids or grandkids, they can't get it out. But what they can be given by you is the authority to manage the donor advised fund as far as deciding what charities get the money. So if your family tithes 10% of their income on a regular basis to their church, you could be helping your future children and grandchildren by saying, look, take from the donor advised fund some of the money that you're going to tithe and get it to your church. And it doesn't have to come from your income. Your income can go to other things that help you. I'm just thinking outside the box, but these are ways that you can look at the remainder inside the CRT at the death of the second spouse, in this case that Pete's given, that it can still kind of benefit the family. So can you think of any other ways, Pete, besides life insurance and maybe a donor advised fund to be the ultimate charity that you've worked with people? Or do you just have some people say, nope, I ultimately wanted to go to the American Cancer Society and to heck with it? What do you see with the people you work with?
Well, I've seen people name 4, 5, 6 different charities to be the ultimate recipient of it, and it would be, they tend to be more the national, sometimes local. And then I always, at least when I was doing them, I would always give the donor the ability, and this is permissible, to change the ultimate charitable beneficiary. So if they didn't like what the particular charity was doing, they could change that beneficiary to another charity that perhaps they were more in tune with their charitable purpose. But the other is the charitable, the donor advised fund, Jim, that you mentioned. I like that a lot. And the reason I do is because the funds then can be spread out over any number of charities. With the donor advised fund, you don't have to name the ultimate recipients, charitable recipients of the money. And it can be left up to your children to make those decisions as to what, if any, charities will receive any distributions in a particular year, well after the trust is terminated and well after the lives of the donors who established all this. So I like the flexibility. I like the way it works. And the only requirement is that they be a domestic tax qualifying charity to receive it. So it could be the church, synagogue, could be a national organization, could be a very local charity. Or something, maybe a charity that the kids are involved in. Don't be mistaken, this is not a way to funnel these charitable funds to your family. That doesn't work that way. That does surely have to go to a charity and be used for its charitable purpose.
Right. At the end, it goes to a charity. What I like about the donor advised fund as well, and you do hit the nail on the head, the donor advised fund can pretty much give to any charity. Now, you can set them up very restrictive as well and say it can only go to these types of charities. But if you keep it very broad, as Pete said, it just has to be a domestic charity. And it just allows the children or future grandchildren, Pete, or other family members that you may not even meet, because these donor advised funds can go on for a long time. This charity could help family members who want to be charitable, and they can donate from the donor advised fund and then allow their money that they would have donated to go to the family, maybe to go to school or to buy clothes or food or who knows. So it just allows the future children and grandchildren a little flexibility. They can still do their tithing or gifting, but not necessarily with their money. Does that make sense, what I'm trying to explain?
It does. It does. The other thing is that if the parents want, really do want the funds to go to a particular charity and not be held back or spread out over a different number of charities, then they ought to name that particular charity or charities within the trust so that the money goes to that charity. But if they want to leave it up to family members, future family members, and maybe they want to restrict the type of charity in some way, they can do that. But the idea of a donor advised fund is that the donations to the charities would be paid out over time, not in a lump sum.
Perfect. And before you get into a charitable lead trust, which was your other option for these people, is there anything Pete, would ask me to ask Chris or Bob that they might want to do?
I don't know, but they may have a question.
What was that?
I have no idea, but yeah. I didn't mess up a name. That's all I know.
He was testing his memory of names there.
Yeah.
Is there anything you want to add, Bob or Chris, to this before Pete gets into charitable lead trusts?
Chris doesn't. Chris added his clarifying comment a few minutes ago.
Okay. Bob?
I guess the only thing I might add is, you know, you'd kind of mentioned earlier when you have a mixed group of assets and the basis would be pro rata, you know, you could have higher, some of the assets could be higher basis than others. So you could selectively say, we're going to put all the equipment in the CRT and sell the inventory or vice versa. And so you could structure it to have the lowest basis assets, I guess, contributed to the CRT to maximize that deferral.
And that's a great point, because you can do that.
Perfect. So in the case where it's not an LLC unit or something like that, and it's actually crops or equipment or something different, you can say, hey, we're going to retain these high basis assets, and we're going to put into the CRT these low basis, highly taxable assets. Is that correct?
Right. Rather than just doing like 50% of both, just be selective about maybe what you want to.
Gotcha.
Contribute.
So it makes it even better, folks. Now, because we got pretty deep and we're going a little bit long,
let me interrupt you. You had mentioned a NIM. You had promised.
The NIMCRAT. I'm sorry. Yes. Why don't you explain what those strategies will allow to do? So in the scenario, folks, let's just say the people did all this and they chose the 10% payout. They're not too concerned with a big charitable deduction because they got to defer taxes on $400,000 of gain, so that they got their tax benefit. So they're taking 10% out, the 10% of the $500,000 inside, the $400,000 deferred gain, and the $100,000 a basis in our example. So they're getting $50,000 a year, Chris. Yes, Chris, I was talking to you, and we were going to share this with Pete, that... The
very smooth, very smooth.
I did not mess up a name.
We're not done yet.
So, Pete, where does the strategy of a NIMCRAT, net income makeup, or NIMCRAT, net income makeup is what the NIM stands for. What is the purpose of that? Lay out a scenario where someone might want that language in their CRT.
Well, I've used that almost exclusively on real estate sales. It tends to be more farmland type sales. And the idea is that the real estate is put into this CRT, but we don't know how long it's going to take to actually sell the property. It may be a year, maybe 2 or 3 years before the full value can be realized. And so the problem with that is that under a standard CRT, let's just say it's a 5% payout, 5% of that value has to be paid out each year, even though the only asset in the trust is the land. So the donor doesn't really want the land back. They've already given that away, and there's no way to avoid having to make that 5% payment. So they're faced with a choice. They can either deed 5% of the property back to the trustee would deed 5% of the property back to them, which would involve appraisals each year, which are not inexpensive. Or there's the net income makeup provision, which says that if the trust has to be designed in the trust at the beginning, but if it is, then it says the trust will pay out the lesser of 5% or the income generated within the trust. And so the income, since it's farmland, it may only have, say, a sharecrop, or it may be rental, or it may have, but the income's going to be limited. So what it does avoid then is the requirement that part of that real estate be deeded back. So they would distribute the amount of the income. But let's just say that it's not rented and there's no sharecrop or other arrangement on the land. So there would be no distributions, but that 5% doesn't go away. So each year, the 5% then goes into the makeup account, and it's held. It's kind of like an IOU. So first year, it's 5% of the value of the trust. Second year, it's the 5% of the value of that second year added to that. So there's an IOU account. And then when the property sells, then the first money coming out will be that makeup amount that they've deferred on, plus then the 5% distribution for the current year, the year of the sale. So it allows them to then time those distributions if they can control the sale. But more importantly, it allows them to put in property that may not be sold within a year or two, or won't be sold immediately, so that they don't have to deed out parts of the real estate, in my example. There's another use for it, too. If someone decides that they're going to put assets into the trust and the assets are sold. So let's take our example where it's crops and equipment and other items. So the property is sold. Well, that year they're going to, if we set it up as an IMCRUT, where remember it's the lesser of income or 5%. So in year one, when it's sold, they'll get their 5%. But if that income then is, or the proceeds from the sale are invested in a deferred annuity, then it can grow within the annuity. And the sort of rule is that if it's in a deferred annuity, the only time the income is recognized is when the dollars are distributed from the deferred annuity to the trust. Remember, the trust invested in the deferred annuity. So the trustee then can control the amount of income that would be available for distribution out to the donor in this case. So it's a way to defer the distributions. Where I've used it is where we've had a client that would set up a CRT maybe for a grandchild, and they didn't want any money coming out to the grandchild, but what they were looking at is that the fund college. So they invest the money into a deferred annuity. When the child then entered their freshman year of college, they may then pull out money, enough money out of the deferred annuity that it would then provide for the tuition and room and board for that grandchild for that year. And then each year thereafter, they would do the same thing. So they could control when the distributions were required to be made.
Right. And we've used those, or at least chatted about those with you. Also, especially when IRAs are being left to CRTs, to protect beneficiaries, if for some reason a lot of people will put IRAs into CRTs at their death. and then pay out 5% or 10% to their children for the rest of their children's lives. And there could be a time, Pete, where sending that money to the child wouldn't be a wise thing. They're being sued, or they're being going through a divorce, or they have a drug problem. So then you can control it by putting the proceeds of that trust into the deferred annuity, like you say. So magically, there is no income anymore, because there's no income until the trustee takes it out of the annuity. And then the payments don't have to go to the beneficiary if it's a bad time. So that's where I've seen them used. Is that correct, the way I've described it?
Yeah, it can be, sure.
Okay, so the point we're trying to make, folks, using this strategy, if you time creating this and talk to a competent attorney and planner who knows these concepts, you can really help yourself from a tax perspective. But when I reached out to Pete and said, hey, I want you to talk about CRTs, he said, well, in these low interest rate environments, we might want to talk about CLTs. And that's a trust that we haven't really talked about much on this show, charitable lead trusts. Why don't you explain a little how this might be another option that this particular person or other listeners might be able to benefit from, Pete, with this low interest rate environment?
Well, the charitable lead trust is kind of the mirror image of the charitable remainder trust, in that it's kind of the reverse, where the charity gets the income or payout during the term of the trust. And then at the end of the term, then the remainder beneficiary can be the donor, or it can be other family members of the donor. And so the charitable remainder trust provides the greatest benefit for the income interest in a high interest rate environment. So right now, we're in a low interest rate environment. So when we are running our calculations for the remainder trust, remember the charitable deduction was either $40,000 or $131,000 in that interest rate environment. And so because it's a low interest rate environment, the donor under a charitable remainder trust receives less than they would in a charitable lead trust. So with a charitable lead trust, the donor is the remainder interest and the charity is the income, or gets the income distributions. So in a charitable lead trust, then the charity gets less than they would in a higher interest rate environment. And the charity then, or I should say the donor or their family, whoever the remainder beneficiary is, will then has the potential to receive more. And so when we're in a low interest rate environment, the charitable lead trusts work quite well, and we're about as low as you can go right now.
So
as I look at the interest rates, we're down to, you know, a fraction of 1%.
Right. So in English, folks, what Pete just said, in these low interest rate environments, I think it's 0.8, isn't it, Pete?
Well, let's see. July is 0.6, May was 0.8, and June was 0.6.
So 0.6 is the interest rate, folks, that the government is going to make you use on a charitable lead trust. So follow the math here. Now, that's the payout to the charity, Chris. Could you ask Pete that?
I don't have to ask Pete that, because the answer would be yes, you would use that rate to calculate the income that's being paid from a charitable lead trust to the charity.
Perfect. See, I wanted Chris to get his words in. He hasn't been talking much.
I know, and that was very generous of you. But
thank you.
But let me say that just like with the charitable remainder trust, the payout rate is built into the trust. So remember we talked about 5% and 10% with the charitable remainder trust? Same thing for a charitable lead trust. You would set the percentage rate when the trust was prepared. The 0.6 interest rate is what's applied to calculate the charitable deduction and the value of the remainder interest. So, for example, we have use our $400,000 that we've been playing around with, and if we had a payout rate of 5%, then that would mean the payment to the charity would be $20,000 per year for the term of the trust. And then what's the value of that? When we run the calculation based on the 0.6%, which is the lowest rate and the most advantageous, then what we're looking at is a Let me look here and see if we can, if I can figure this out. Let me get to it. Okay, here we go. So the present value of the annuity, that would be the amount going to charity, is almost $362,000. So that's the charitable deduction.
Yeah, that's a good point, Pete, because the way I said it, I agree. It doesn't directly set the payment to the charity. It sets the benefit of the payments to the charity, the benefit to the donor, the payments to the charity. So yes, the good. Thank you for clarifying that.
In this case, if the charitable deed trust can invest the money and make more than 0.6%, then there'll be that much more left at the remainder. And if we think interest rates are going up, then the lead trust would not be a bad idea to use.
And that's
the other point.
Oh, go ahead, Pete. Keep going.
The other point is this $362,000 deduction you get in the year that the trust is set up. So you get that today because that's the present value of the $20,000 per year for the term of the trust. So what you're doing is you're taking your charitable contributions for, in this case, 23 years, and dumping them all into year one to offset the $400,000 of gain that you're having to recognize from the sale of the property. And then over the next 23 years, then if the trust can earn more than the 0.6%, then there'll be money coming back, and from 0.6% to where it would normally be, I would think, the donor would stand to get a good chunk of their money back, plus they got the deduction.
Exactly, and that's what I wanted to get to. Pete is using software. Are you using Number Cruncher right now, Pete?
I am.
Okay, that's what I figured. There's software out there we use called Number Cruncher. And that's how he's getting all this. It's set up for estate planners. And the advantage that we're trying to show with the lead trust, you still have, under our scenario, remember, you've got $400,000 a gain that you have to put on your tax return, and you just deferred $400,000 by getting it into now a charitable lead trust. You would use a lead trust if you don't need any income. And what you're trying to do is maybe pass this on to the older you as a lump sum later for some, maybe for long-term care needs or something like that. Or you're going to leave it to another child beneficiary at your death. But what you do, you don't need income now. So the charity gets the income now. And all's what you have to do is earn more than 0.6%, which you should be able to earn substantially more than that over 23 years. And where do we come up with 23 years? In Number Cruncher, it looks at your age and applies the current IRS mortality tables and says, okay, you are probably going to live 23 more years. This trust has to be set up to pay out over 23 years. So the trust is going to send 20 grand a year, in Pete's example, every year out. But if you can earn more than the imputed interest of 0.6, your trust basis is going to keep growing. So at the end of 23 years, there could be a hell of a lot of money in that trust, even though it paid out 20 grand a year. But in the meantime, you get a $360,000 deduction in year one. And what is that $360,000 deduction, Bob, going to do to that $400,000 of income you have to declare?
Well, it's going to get, there'll be a limitation, but it's certainly going to knock that year down. And then the rest of the donation that's above the threshold limits, we'll just carry forward to the following year.
Exactly. What Bob's meaning, you're not going to be able to use it all, but you're going to be able to use a good chunk of it and offset a lot of the income taxes owed on that $400,000. And then the following year, any deduction that you didn't get, you can take that year. But you use a charitable lead trust when you don't need the income. Now, this particular listener never really said if they need income or not. They were just wondering how they can lower their taxes using CRTs. What we were trying to explain to them is You might want to use a CLT or a CRT, but you might want to do it by getting the CRT or CLT created before you find a buyer and get your ducks in a row and look at it another way. Don't do it just by selling everything, getting $800,000 a gain, and then trying to defer it. Ain't going to happen. You're not going to get that big of a benefit. Go ahead, whoever was going to say something.
Let me interrupt you for a second here. Unlike the charitable remainder trust, the charitable deed trust is not a charity. So generally, we don't recommend that appreciated assets or assets that are about to be sold be placed into the deed trust because its income tax rates are compressed, so it would end up paying more tax on it. So the idea in this case would be to sell the crops and equipment in this year, create the charitable lead trust this year, and then make your donation and set the trust up and generate this compressed charitable deduction in this year to offset the bulk of that gain. And then Bob's right, what you can't use this year, you can carry forward for an additional 5 years if you have enough income to cover that.
So
the other thing that I wanted to point out is I just ran it based on the lives of the people involved for their lifetime. I've never done a charitable deed trust for a lifetime. We usually set it up for a term of years. It can be 5 years, 10 years, maybe as much as 20. Generally, for this purpose, it doesn't make sense to do it for 20 years, but that may be the case if you have some young donors. But what you're trying to do is to calculate what is the best income tax deduction over what period of time and with the right interest rate. So you're running numbers to figure out where you maximize the charitable deduction and the term and the payout rate. So it's a calculation, but the trust will pay income tax on its earnings over that period of time.
Gotcha. So why do they call it a charitable lead trust if it's not a charity, like a charitable remainder trust is a charity?
Well, the charity gets the income distributions each year.
Okay.
In the lead, the first payouts go to the charity rather than
what's remaining
going to the charity.
Gotcha.
They stand in the lead position is the way I always remember it.
So if the people listening are going to do that strategy, and thank you for correcting me on that, they don't want to use the charitable lead trust in the same manner. They don't want to. That would be the preferred strategy under their scenario, Pete. They sell everything. They have this massive gain. In our example, we're saying $800,000. And they're asking, should they use a charitable remainder trust? You're saying no. Use a charitable lead trust, and here's why. Correct?
Yeah, right. And so in this case, what I would suggest, since we're going to be recognizing the gain or the income on the donor's income tax return, what they would do is put in the amount of the gain, $800,000, not the full million that they sold it for. And then if they did that under the current structure with a 5% payout rate, their income tax deduction would be almost $724,000. So they have $800,000 a gain and they have $724,000 deduction, and then their tax on the difference, the $200,000 they retained out, would be more than enough to cover that tax. And then since they don't need income for the 10 years or 5 years or whatever term it runs, that then they could they'll get that money, whatever's left in there. And by the way, if the shorter the term, it comes down to the percentage calculation is fixed. What we can play with is the payout rate and the term. So we have two variables that we can play with to try to maximize the charitable deduction over the shortest period of time.
Okay, so I like that strategy. But I'm a little confused on something. Bob, would they get the full 700 something thousand deduction, or would that be limited to, what is it, 50 or 60%? I forget how that all works.
Well, I believe since you're at this point contributing the cash, you would get the highest percentage, which is now currently 60%. of your AGI would be deductible as an itemized deduction in year one. And then, as Pete said, the rest would carry forward for up to 5 years. So part of the planning is to make sure you can use it up within the 5 years too, so you don't lose it.
That's a good point.
Okay, so they'll be limited to 60% of their AGI in that year, but that's still going to be a massive deduction, and then they can carry the rest forward. But as you point out, Bob, if they then have no income or very minimal income going forward, they're not going to be able to capture the remainder amount that they're carrying forward for another 4 years, correct?
Correct, yes. And okay. I've kind of seen that sort of happen to people in the past, where they, all of a sudden their income was so low that they were having trouble using up the deduction that was part of the original plan.
But if they have an IRA, they could be converting. If they had no income, they could do a conversion tax-free almost in some years.
Yeah, we shelter at least half of it probably, yep. Yeah. So, you know, if you had that opportunity, but you just want to have all that kind of laid out in the front.
And make a plan. Fancy that.
Right. So you need a plan, a tax plan, folks. Pete, a few more questions on the CLT, and then we'll wrap up just so our listeners understand. So unlike the CRT, whose payments go to the donor for a very long time, maybe the rest of their lives, under the CLT, you have the payments go to charities, but much quicker. 5, 10 or so years. And then the trust just absolves, I guess, and a big lump sum of money goes to the beneficiary. I'm confused at that point how that is taxed.
Well, at that point, it's going to come out with no tax, because remember, the trust is paying its tax as it goes. So it gets a deduction for the distributions to the chair. Well, it does not get a deduction, because the deduction has already been paid. So it's been paying its taxes on the income as it's earned. So when it terminates, the only tax that would be carried out to the, if it's going back to the donor, let's just say the only tax that would be due when it's distributed to the beneficiary in the year of termination is going to be on the income earned for that year.
Now, because you have high trust compressed tax rates, if there's a lot of money in there and it's generating a lot of earnings, those earnings, that's what's being distributed to the trust, to the charity, correct?
Well, the earnings are, because it's got to be a cash distribution.
So inside the CLT, you've got these hundreds of thousands of dollars. The charities under your scenario were getting, what, $20,000 a year, you were saying, Pete?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Okay, so $20,000 a year for 10 years is going to these charities. If the trust is earning $30,000 of income, the trust is only going to file a tax return and essentially have to pay taxes on $10,000 of income, all 30?
No, all 30, because the tax deduction... Right? They're going to have to pay it on all 30, correct?
Right.
The donor already got the benefit.
Taken up front outside the trust.
Gotcha. So would you not want to use a deferred annuity inside the CLT then to control all this high taxes that could be owed? Remember, you get the compressed tax rates of the highest marginal bracket above $12,750.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you want to, I mean, this may sound like a unique concept, but you may want to be working with a financial advisor who can defer, invest in growth, invest in a deferred annuity to determine what you're doing is just minimizing the amount of recognizable income in any 1 year.
Okay, so humor me this, and maybe you or Bob will know, or Chris will know, what happens. Let's just say you put the money in. We talk a lot on our podcast of no fee, no commission, variable annuities, low cost, no commission, kind of just a wrapper variable annuity. you put that in there and you have aggressive investments in there because it's a variable annuity, so you have some investments in there. And it's growing and earning a lot, but no taxes are owed because the money is still inside the variable annuity. Now, the trustee would distribute from that variable annuity every year enough money to go to the charity, still, again, going straight to the charity, so the trust isn't paying taxes on it. But
the trust will have to recognize that income, Jeff.
That's what I was going to say. Okay, so the trust does have to recognize that because the Okay.
But they're limited to recognize the income and the amount that's going out to the charity because that's what's being forced out of the variable annuity in your particular
in my
example.
Scenario. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So they the trust would have to pay taxes on the $20,000.
Right.
Okay. Now let's just say at the end there's a big variable annuity in there after 10 years and there's a lot of money in there. And that's now going to pay out to the beneficiaries, but then they would have to pay taxes on all that gain in that year, correct?
If that money is distributed out of the annuity, if the annuity is distributed, then they would recognize
that's how you get around it.
You continue to defer it. You'll eventually have to pay the piper, but
as you take it out
of the VA.
I knew there had to be a way around it. So now you've got this variable annuity. The trust just distributes the variable annuity, so it's no longer in the trust. And now the beneficiary, I'm not sure who owns the variable annuity at this point, but now the variable annuity is sitting there, and now the beneficiary can control the distributions from that VA and take a little every year until they can finally get it closed down.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, I see it. All right, so listeners, we went way down into the weeds on a very advanced topic this week, and that's why we brought Pete and Bob. Notice I didn't screw up any names. I told you I'd win this bet. Mm-hmm. And Bob, didn't we bet like $50?
I think there was a glitch about 15 minutes ago.
No, there wasn't.
You tried to cover it.
I tell you what, I'll give you credit for doing remarkably well. Luckily, I don't remember any dollar amount.
I do, $50.
To your favorite charity, right?
Yeah, the Jimmy Fund. So I do want to thank Bob and Pete for coming on, especially you, Pete, because these were very advanced topics. The point is, listeners, if you guys counsel, I know you all do-it-yourselfers, and you refuse to pay anyone for advice, but sometimes you have to say, you know what? This is above my pay grade. You might be able to manage your money at Vanguard and do it quite well, and we're not picking on you. 99% of our clients have all their portfolios at Vanguard. We have no problem with that, but occasionally you need to hire professionals. And if you are contemplating selling any type of business or farm or real estate or highly appreciated assets, you really should counsel with well-trained CPAs and well-trained tax attorneys and estate planning attorneys like Pete, although Pete is retiring eventually, and they can save you far more in taxes then you're going to pay them in a fee. The concepts talked about today, I would put at a, you know, this isn't a 101 level, Chris. This is like a 401, a 501 level depth of today's topic. You need professionals helping you with this. But listener who sent us that email, there are ways to use charitable trusts, maybe not a CRT, maybe a CLT, maybe creating it before the sale or after, that you need to evaluate and things you need to look at. When is the deduction going to happen? How much of that deduction is going to get carried forward? Is your income going to be high enough in the subsequent 4 or 5 years of carry forwards to be able to use the remaining part of the deduction, or is that going to be lost? Could you time these carry forwards with Roth conversions into the future to get some tax-free conversions? All that is going to be worth the fee of a quality attorney and or CPA. And I think both Bob and Paul...
Oh, there it was.
Who the
You're
hell
right.
is
that
Paul?
That was $50 bet.
Yeah, it was. It was a $50 bet.
Yeah, I remember now.
Who is Paul? I was so close.
You were.
Oh my.
Now, that's the little reward for people to have sat through this entire hour and 15 minutes of high-level trust talk. That's going to be a popular... I'll clean up the tirade a little bit, but yeah, that'll be good.
No, you need the tirade because this is ridiculous.
I'm
going to
include it. I'm just going to clean it up a little bit.
I had 4 minutes to go.
Mm-hmm. If that.
Paul, when would I ever call anyone Paul?
You were in your final 30 seconds, I think.
Now I'm mad.
Well, on that note,
I'm done.
I want to thank Bob and Pete myself, because this was great. I learned some stuff and got refreshed on a few things that at one point I tried to learn because I had to for the CFP certification. That we did go through most of this stuff in estate planning education modules, but unless you use it regularly, it gets pretty rusty pretty quickly. So actually kind of enjoyable to knock off some of that rust and learn a couple new things too. So thanks a lot, Pete and Bob.
You're welcome.
And I'll let you guys go, and I'll close out the show here and tell people how they can get a hold of us. So you guys have a good day.
Okay.
All right. Okay.
Thanks,
well, thank
guys.
You.
We'll talk to you later.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Paul, I was so close.
Oh, and then we get a siren at the end too. They're coming to save you. This is the open window technique during COVID.
Right. Why don't you explain to everyone? Because I have to head downstairs and get some work done. Explain to everyone that we might be unpausing shortly. So if anyone,
well, shortly might be an aggressive word, but
well, you can explain.
Okay, I'll tell them. Okay. Well, we do want to thank everybody for listening, especially with these long EDU shows in a thick topic. I know there's a few of you that really eat this stuff up, so hopefully this satisfied your hunger for this type of topic for a while. We like getting Pete on here in particular because I always learn something new when Pete's on. And if you have your own idea for a topic, feel free to reach out to us. The way this emailer sent us this question or topic was going to jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. On that website, you can reach out to us via the contact form. You can also learn a little bit more about us, what we do, what we specialize in, really all things surrounding the active retirement and funding retirement. That's our focus here at this firm. And we are currently paused for taking on new clients. We are active. We aren't just podcasters. We are active financial planners specializing in retirement planning in particular. We put a pause earlier this year on taking new clients because we need to build some more infrastructure here at the firm to handle the demand that we were seeing. But we're getting a bit caught up on that, and we're seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. So I'm not going to put a date on it yet, but as we approach the fourth quarter, so over the next couple of months, that light at the end of the tunnel will get brighter and brighter, and we will likely be able to unpause for certain folks later this year. But we'll keep everybody up to date on the podcast here. So if you're interested in working with us, we'll kind of let you know how if that light keeps getting brighter or not. There's lots of variables in play, most of which are out of our control. The whole COVID thing has slowed down a few things, but we're working through it. And so that's about all that we've got today. And we really appreciate everybody. And we'll see you next week with another new show. Investors should consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of investment company products carefully before investing. The prospectus contains this and other information about the investment company. Prospectuses may be obtained from your advisor and should be read in full. All guarantees are backed by the claims-paying ability of the issuing insurer. Withdrawals and death benefits are subject to income tax. If withdrawals and other distributions are received prior to age 59 and a half, a 10% penalty may apply. Shares, when redeemed, may be worth more or less than the original cost.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.